Detroit's many titles, the Motor City, Motown, now the label bankrupt.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. Detroit this morning is officially bankrupt. Its emergency manager, Kevin Orr, could not persuade enough stakeholders to restructure the city's nearly $20 billion debt.
Each restructuring I've been in, many of them, most of them, as a matter of fact, successful, I've heard the same thing. This is a crisis. The magnitude is huge. How can this ever happen? This is a testament to failure. Not at all. Bankruptcy, from my perspective, for those of us in this business, and restructuring, this is a tool.
Orr says the city's not closing and city services will continue. Kate Davidson reports now on what's next.
Now that Detroit's filed for Chapter 9, it gets
breathing room.
Paul Mako is a partner at law firm Bracewell Giuliani, specializing in municipal securities.
It gives them a chance to work out over an extended period of time problems that may be immediately confronting them.
He says municipal bankruptcies often pit bondholders, investors who buy a city's debt, against pensioners, retired public employees. Both were promised payments, and bondholders usually come out ahead. Still, bankruptcy expert Jim Spioto says filing for Chapter 9 could damage a city's credit rating in the bond market.
What is the future impact on the municipality and its ability to borrow? Any municipality of size needs on a regular basis access to the municipal market at a low cost.
There's also been a lot of talk about whether Detroit will have to sell off assets like an airport, its largest park, or a prized art collection. Maybe, but not because a judge so orders. Unlike in corporate bankruptcy, the municipality makes that call. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Now let's do the numbers. The FT 100 in London is down 0.4% right now. The key stock index in Shanghai fell 1.5% overnight. Yesterday, the Dow went up 78 points, 0.5%, but Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are all down at the moment. In the pre-2008 boom years, speculators liked to flip houses, and AM radio used to run ads suggesting this was a financial strategy for nearly everyone, a dubious proposition, many experts say. But a new report out today shows the number of people flipping houses now, that is, buying and selling within 6 months, is up 74% in the last 2 years. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
The geography of flipping has, well, flipped. Southern California and Arizona are no longer the hot spots. Now flippers are flocking to states like Arkansas and Nebraska. Darren Bloomquist is with Realty Track, which produced the report.
We're seeing higher levels of flipping than we saw even back during the housing bubble of 2004 to 2008, which is a little bit of a red flag.
But even if some homebuyers do overpay, Bloomquist doesn't expect another bubble. For one thing, banks no longer give away easy money. Brad Hunter is chief economist for a housing research firm called Metro Study. Before the last bubble, he says people were flipping new houses, which prompted the industry to overbuild.
It's now more of an investor rather than just a pure speculator or flipper.
His research shows that many home buyers are turning properties into rental units. And with people living in the homes, the owners are less likely to walk away. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
Today it's the release of Red 2, the caper movie with John Malkovich and Helen Mirren. You hear the numeral 2 in the title, then you can see Despicable Me 2 as well, and you start to see a trend. Derek Thompson, business editor at The Atlantic, has been analyzing all these 2s in search of a theme. Morning, Derek.
Good morning.
All right, divine a trend for me here. Like, what works for Hollywood?
This is a very easy trend to divine, I think. Sequels, adaptations, and reboots define the business of Hollywood. Hollywood is in the business of building franchises, I think, and using audience familiarity to draw people into the cinema. And so what you see is that they're not taking a lot of risks on original ideas.
I'm sure there are directors who wish that people would just go online, watch a little trailer, do a little reading, and gravitate to something unfamiliar. But you're saying that might not be a money-making strategy.
Right. And it's not just Americans who have access to, say, apple.com/trailers. The problem is that audience growth is entirely overseas. If you look at the domestic box office, it's pretty static, especially once you take away the money from 3D movies. Think about it. Clever dialogue doesn't translate easily into Mandarin. But you know what translates really easily into any language is explosions. And so it makes sense to make movies with explosions that can be seen and enjoyed by enormous cities in Africa, Europe, Latin America, Asia, and Australia. The other problem that these studios have in the U.S. is that in the 1940s, 80% of families went to the movies every weekend. Right now, about 5% do.
Why? We're watching on big screens at home, or we just have other pastimes?
We have other pastimes, and TV is huge. These movie studios have to spend $30, $40, $100 million in marketing to get people to the movies. And if you understand that Americans are only going to go to the movies a few times a year, it doesn't make any sense to bet $100 million on all 20 movies Warner Brothers produces. It makes sense to spend $100 million marketing a handful of tentpole movies to tell the audience, we know you only go to the movies five times a year. Here is the one movie you have to see this month.
Derek Thompson, business editor at The Atlantic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And in about 2.5 hours, organizers of next year's World Cup in Brazil announce ticket prices. The details will come 3 weeks later than planned. Organizers insist the delay has nothing to do with the street protests and other civil unrest that happened to strike Brazil around the original deadline. Top ticket prices at the last World Cup, the one in South Africa, ran at about $1,000 each. As we've been reporting, Brazilians are upset about public corruption, among other things. But there's also a sense in Brazil that the government has been overly focused on preparations for the World Cup at the expense of regular Brazilians. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.